This is Jay Abraham, and this is really going to be fun. I today sat down intent on doing one thing, and through a very bizarre but a wonderful sequence of events, ended up getting ready to do something far more profound, far more valuable, far more profitable, and far more stimulating to me than what we started. I'm on my computer, and on the other end, about 1,000 miles away, is Brian Kurtz, who I've known and appreciated, respected for more years than I want to chronicle. He has been one of the iconic and seminal figures in direct marketing. We grew up sort of together. I'm older than he is. He has emerged as arguably the default and definitive go-to source and most trusted advisor in direct response marketing, really right now, for the emerging genre of direct marketers and independent marketers and entrepreneurial marketers. He has a really profound context of reference and understanding, because he started in direct mail, as did I. He evolved to infomercials and killed it. He's done online. He now organizes and mentors, masterminds some of the most impressive and really successful, what I will call aggregate direct response marketers. And an aggregate marketer to me is a newly coined, instantaneously, you can use it if you want. It means someone who's integrating a multitude of different direct marketing techniques, technologies, and methods to basically access the market from as many impact and vantage points. Brian understands things that are very powerful, and he's very gifted in his ability to simplify it in elegant and almost disarming language. I'm going to try to pry out of him lovingly but ruthlessly ideas, lessons, insights, perspectives that anyone in business can use. One of the things I have to preface with is my stature began, if you hear a little noise, it's raining and I'm in New York and my window is getting pummeled sideways, which is weird rain. I started my career by doing something I thought very simple. I took direct response marketing techniques, which were disciplined, which were measurable, which were very scientific, and I taught them to general non-direct response entrepreneurs, business owners, professionals in private practice, and they all killed it because all their competitors were using institutional advertising. And now, with the multitude of media that's out there, there are fundamentals that are immutable. There are techniques that 90% of the new marketers don't even understand, utilize, harness, or revere. And today we're going to liberate and release those to the world, and you're going to see the magnitude, and also we're going to showcase the enormous bounty of knowledge that resides in Brian's brain. Brian, hi.
So let me just go back. Let me reverse the table on you, because, you know, we were kind of like going back and forth for the last, you know, whatever. We've been in touch a lot lately, and you've come as a guest to one of my mastermind groups. You're coming again. You know, I owe so much of my education and career to you and to what you've taught me. And we're not going to turn this into just a simple love fest. We're going to get into some detailed direct response wisdom both ways. But it was funny because I wrote this book, and you were the first one, as my mentor, as my friend, kind of told me what was wrong with the book immediately. And it's a book that I co-wrote, and I'm very proud of it because I think it does do some good stuff about harnessing the past and talking about the fundamentals that you and I dream of. But, you know, you just basically, because every good mentor tells the truth, and, you know, that I have you in my life to say things like, Brian, you're better than this book. Not to say the book's bad, but that you're better than this book. Not many people are going to say that to me. Most people are going to blow sunshine up my butt and say, Brian, you're wonderful. And Brian, you're, you know this stuff like the back of your hand, and, and it's the most amazing book ever written. And so it started with that. And then we started talking about, what we could do to kind of share with the industry what's in the book, but what's not in the book, and what you and I have experienced together over these last 35 years that we've known each other. And it occurred to me, it's like, okay, Jay, so interview me for your list. And it's like, all right, I can do that. And then I said, well, wait a minute. That's a waste. Why should you just interview me? I think this is going to be a dual interview. I'm probably surprising you with this now, saying that you can distill whatever you want and pull whatever you want out of my brain, but I'm not going to waste my time on this hour without coming back at you with all kinds of stuff so I can send this interview to my list and they can get the wisdom. I mean, I didn't get, you don't, probably don't care about this, but I got more likes on a Facebook picture of me and you than I did of anything I've ever posted on Facebook. And I knew, I knew that when I did the Titans event in 2014, that getting you on stage to be, one of the icons that I needed to be there if I was going to talk about the Titans of Direct Response, that it, the event couldn't have happened had you not been there. So that's the, enough of the Mutual Admiration Society. But
right. So let's roll up.
Let's dive in.
And let's just go for it. And I'm going to, in a bloodless coup, usurp you and start. And then you can have your intellectual way with me later. But let's plumb your brain first. So let's go back without dating you. Let's go back to the beginning. But I don't want to really go into the companies as much as I want to go into the methodologies, because I think those are profound. So you started many years ago, and you started in direct response, and you started in direct mail, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so let's start with the most impactful lessons that were indelibly instilled in you, and your background's boardroom, bottom line, and you were basically, in my opinion, the secret weapon that made that company grow. And I've always admired your understated prowess. But let's talk about lessons learned that drove your success, or at least profoundly impacted you in the beginning, and then whether or not you evolved those, abandoned those, expanded those, translated those, okay?
Great question. And the thing that just kept on like a flashing neon light in my head was my understanding of mailing lists. It sounds so simple and sounds so mundane. But when I started, and luckily, my first job at Boardroom was the in-house list manager, where Boardroom had these incredible lists of subscribers and book buyers, of affluent executives, all of whom would plop down $39 for a book or a newsletter, and they were affluent, they had time on their hands, they were older, they were established, they looked for intellectual stimulation, they were mail order junkies, and I say that term fondly. So I had this incredible opportunity that I stepped into with Marty Edelston, who started the company Boardroom, who, obviously you and he were very fond of each other, and that's how, we all were like one big happy family back then, and we loved Jay Abraham. So when I got to Boardroom and I was working in this thing called in-house list management, most companies would give their mailing list back in the 1980s to some company to represent their list in the marketplace. You want to rent our list, you have a direct mail offer from Money Magazine, come use the Boardroom list. I have a list of fundraising people from, political fundraising donors, and I want to rent that list for disabled American veterans, blah, blah, blah. Big business. The list business was huge. The Boardroom list business was exceptionally huge, if there is such a way to put that. And I was basically in the middle of putting my list on the market, the Boardroom list on the market, and watching every single mailer use my list in different ways with different selections, whether it's home address, business address, by zip code, back then we didn't even have the statistical modeling ability right away. We got it later on. But when I watched this go, and I watched the 1.5% and 2% response rates creating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and profit for the businesses in direct mail at the time, I realized the power of the list. And, you know, it was funny because I always thought that when Marty was introducing me to all the best copywriters in the world, that it was all about the creative. It was all about the great sales letter, the great direct mail package by Gene Schwartz or by our internal copywriter, Mel Martin, or Jim Rutz or Gary Bensavenga or whoever. And look, they wrote world-class copy, and I was exposed to all of that early in my career as well. But you know what? You match world-class copy to a list that isn't targeted, you will make zero money. But you match mediocre copy to a targeted list with a great offer, and you're going to make millions in your sleep. And then you add world-class copy to that, now you're cooking on all cylinders. And that's been the progression of my entire career, was based on the fact that I understood list universes. I understood that there was different messaging that was needed to the different list segments, to the different list universes. And so even in direct mail, I had what we call multiple controls. I had, you know, three different control packages for the same product, because I understood that there was, you know, the women needed to be talked to differently. The people who were both subscribers and book buyers, multi-buyers, needed to be talked to differently. And the people who were expired subscribers, who were our best list, needed to be talked to differently. And so just things like that exponentially took Boardroom from just a company sending out a good direct mail piece to one list to a multifaceted creative department and creative controls to multi-segmented lists. And if I take it all the way to the present, and we don't want to skip over everything in between, everything I do today is actually based on that online. And it's so much easier to do online. I don't have to pay postage and printing to send out five different versions of an email to five different segments of an email list. And the results are, again, exponential when you can target those messages to the different list segments and talk to people as if they're family, as opposed to just one homogeneous list. So I'd have to say that if there was one thing early on, was understanding lists. And when Dick Benson, who was the top direct mail consultant at the time, who Boardroom worked with, who became another mentor of mine, turned to me after we spent the day together, and I was helping him with his list selection after he helped me with everything else that Boardroom was doing. We spent the full day. He's telling me every test we ever did, what was good, what was bad, what we should do differently. And then I started helping him with his list selection for his own business. And he looked at me and he says, "You know, Brian, you know, I didn't really know you that well before today, but frankly, I'm impressed." And like, you know, basically I said to Marty when I came back, I said, "Marty, you know, I could retire now." Dick Benson was actually impressed with my knowledge of the list business. And I realized that was going to be my secret sauce for the rest of my career. And it really has been. It really has been.
So let me, I'm realizing that there's really cool formatic we can use in this, because every time you'll address an issue, I will interpret what I heard you say and some nuclear insights. Okay.
That's awesome. Cause yeah, that's why I hang out with you.
So what I heard you say was, first of all, that the media that you're using is probably the most critical, that number two, you can have mediocre copy and brilliant buyer media and do well. If you have good copy, you'll do great. If you have great copy, you'll do better. I learned long ago that the concept transcends the copy. You can have the greatest copy built on the concept, but that the media, I always tell the story of Willie Sutton, the bank robber.
Right.
Hilarious story, but to see, robbed more banks historically than anybody else, and he's still probably years later set the record. When they arrested him, they asked him why he'd robbed so many banks, and his answer was so elegant. He said, "That's where the money is." But the money is where they are already an expressed, not just interest, but fanaticism for either the topic, the subject, the category, the need, the problem, the inner. But you said something else, which I don't think you even realized. You got educated by everyone else in all the ways that you could apply, not just your list, but externally by watching all the different inventive people who were able to come at your list with different products, service offers, and that would have dramatically expanded your sense of possibility. Next is you realize something which I think younger, and I don't mean 20-year-olds, but I mean the latest genre of marketers don't really understand, and that is the absolute power of testing. I mean, one of the people I was talking to you about, yes, a couple of days ago, Drew Kaplan, took $100 and parlayed it into $1 billion just by testing everything from offer, price, media, blah, 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 blah. And the young people and the younger ones today, you know, you got this really wonderful, wonderful technology. A lot of it's a freemium, and you don't have to pay for it. When I was there and you were there, it would take $1 million and 6 months to go through the most analytical test and algorithmic analysis. But you learn the differentiations in two ways. One, that one proposition could outproduce another. And secondly, that you could go after a market from many different impact points. I'm just going to make a point. Years ago, I had a strong relationship with Nightingale Conant, and we had a very expensive product for them, and it was a $500 product, and most of their products were about $50. And we had two different mailing pieces that worked. One was pulling approximately 1.2, and one was pulling 0.9. Now, typical direct response logic would say you go with the 1.2, right?
Right.
But I made them at my, I underwrote it because they wanted to do that. I underwrote with the certainty that if they did both, they wouldn't get 1.2 diluted. They would get 1.2 plus 8 times a multiple, and they did. They got almost 4.0.
Mm-hmm.
People realize that there are a lot of people that are impacted differently. There are a lot of people that have different hot buttons. Do you know Mary Lou Tyler?
I don't.
She wrote a book called Predictable. Oh, I got to remember the name.
Oh, but Predictably Irrational. No, that's a different book, Predictably Irrational. That's Dan Ehrlich.
She and her partner helped take Salesforce from nothing to, and they realized there's four categories. Just throwing some parenthetical comment in. So four categories of buyer progression. One is, and they're very simplistic, but they're totally different. One is unaware, uninterested, unaware, interested, aware, interested, but undecisive, aware, interested, decisive, but not committed. And they're all different. And they figured out how to die. I mean, it's when you look at all the wonderful abilities that are available now, vis-a-vis even when you and I started. But the point you made was, number one, that media is critical. And the more the people already have not just an expressed, but a fanatical a commitment. What I always did was found the fanatics first, and we mailed the begollies out of it so that it would generate a lot of cash so that we could go deeper and afford to lose going into bigger lists that weren't quite as, and it's a strategy. And I'm just throwing a lot of things out. You talked about Dick Benson, and I want to go on record, and I make nothing for this. You have preserved and have available some of the most under-recognized and undervalued and priceless books by masters that on universal and immutable stuff. And you have something by Dick Benson, I believe, and you have something.
Yeah, in fact, you did a blog post about, you know, his 31 rules of thumb, which they were all about direct mail. Dick wasn't even alive when the internet, you know.
No, but they're still almost 98% applicable, which is what
they are. They are.
Let me ask you the next question. And I hope my litany of insights and whatever parenthetical comments doesn't sound like a wild diversion of ADD.
No. In fact, I wanted to just a little bit of an add-on. you know, the interesting thing that I learned so much, I didn't even realize that I did say it. So thank you for bringing up the fact that studying the other people that were using our list gave me the ideas for, you know, what products I might want to go into. That's not stealing. That's stealing smart. You know, stealing's a felony. Stealing's smart.
They paid to not just educate, but to enlighten you.
Exactly. And I wasn't going to rip them off and rip off their product, but who knew that, you know, that I could then, I'll give you an example. I mean, I think that when I started seeing that, you know, the list was mostly, the boardroom list was definitely, you know, moved more right of center politically based on the Republican National Committee mailing our list and Republican candidates mailing our list as opposed to Democrats, it's not that I wanted to go political. Marty and I were very apolitical, and I still am in all of my marketing. However, I was able to then think about some of the things that someone who'd be more conservatively minded might be more interested in, gave that information to my world-class copywriters, and all of a sudden, headlines came out of that that never would have happened had we not studied the people who were what our best customers were buying after they bought the first product, so that when my copywriter was writing the package for the second or third product to that same audience, they came up with copy platforms and strategies that was all based on how the boardroom list was mailed, who it was mailed by, what copy platforms those mailers used, and it was not ripping off any copy, and that's why swipe files are just so valuable. You remember at the Titans event, you remember all the people complaining how we overloaded them with, you know, the binders of...
That's hilarious, isn't it?
It was hilarious to me, and I remember I was on stage, and I'm really sorry that I overloaded you with some of the most valuable assets you'll ever have for the rest of your life. Really sorry, really sorry.
But see, people don't recognize you gave them $1 billion worth of guidance, of modelable. I mean, and most people don't understand the power. I basically, when I got started, just parenthetically, I would collect all the winners and all the full page ads that ran all the time, I had people collecting, and I would sit, you know, painstakingly for hours handwriting every one of those myself so the language would get into my mind. Then I would have a staff member circle every element categorically, headline, call to action, proof.
That is brilliant.
Risk reversal. And I have them aggregated so I could just read them and think about them and read them and think about them. And today's copywriters aren't really deeply trained.
No, I got in front of a bunch of them. You would have been proud of me, Jay. I got in front of them at AWAI, and I had a quote from Gary Halbert and a quote from Gene Schwartz that spoke to that exact thing about, you know, that it does make a difference if you copy this stuff and if you really understand this stuff. And I tell you, I'm always pleased when I see somebody who is a copywriter, who is studying things from the past. I'll tell you a very funny story, which I know you'll enjoy. So Jim Rutz, who's one of the great copywriters of all time,
yes.
He and Gary Bensavenga basically invented the Magalog for the most part, or at least made the Magalog work. And Jim was a very strange man. And
yeah, but they did it totally different, which is really intriguing.
Right. So I wrote a post when Jim passed away, and I called it the copywriter closest to God. He was a very religious man. He started churches. I mean, you know, how's that? I'm not going to just sell boardroom subscriptions. I'm going to start a church with my direct mail prowess. And he did. And the interesting thing, the thing I said in the story, which speaks to exactly what you just said about how you painstakingly went through that stuff, I wrote a thing that Jim Rutz had swipe files as furniture. And what I meant was, when I visited Jim in Colorado Springs, I visited him twice, and I remember going into his dining room or living room area, and there was no furniture in one of these rooms. All it was were piles. There was the boardroom pile. There was the Agora pile. There was the Rodale pile, a big mailer. There was the Phillips Publishing pile, another mailer that we both know. These were like the best mails. And Jim would just accumulate these, and he'd be surrounded by them all day long. And you'd say that's a little sick and a little crazy, But, you know, that's how you become a world-class copywriter. And I'll tell you one other really interesting story, and I said this to the copywriters, and this just blew me away. So I do have the rights to Dick Benson's book. I also have the rights to Gene Schwartz's Breakthrough Advertising, which one of the greatest books ever written. I'm just
reading it
now. And I had a guy who bought the book from me, Breakthrough Advertising, a young copywriter, was so eager and so enthusiastic. And usually you and I both know that sometimes enthusiasm and eagerness translates into virtually no action and nothing after the fact, but sometimes it does. And so he's enthusiastic. I can't wait to get my hands on the book, blah, blah, blah. I've studied Gene. I know about his, you know, how he wrote copy. I've studied Gary Halbert, blah, 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 blah. So I sent him the book. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, I get in the mail a 9x12 envelope with like 100 pages of legal pages, handwritten. What this guy did is, and I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea, but man, it's an idea. He actually, because Breakthrough Advertising, chapters 1 to 3 are some of the most dense copy that you'll ever read. You did a great interview with Kim McCarthy about this, which I own also. And the first three chapters are so dense, you have to read them 6 or 7 times. What's interesting is that one of the greatest copywriters of all time is actually talking more about lists and audience than he is about copy, because he's talking about, you know, that the copywriter doesn't create mass desire. Mass desire is there and you have to fulfill it and you have to harness it.
Yes.
And so what this guy did, this young copywriter, you would have loved this guy. He hand wrote chapters 1 to 3 of Breakthrough Advertising, then photocopied it from legal paper, and he sent it to me to show me. Now, he wasn't asking me for a job. He wasn't asking me for anything. He said, "Brian, I've been following your work. I know you said, Brian, you're too lazy to sit down and rewrite chapters 1 to 3 of Breakthrough Advertising. Well, it's the first thing I did when I received the book from you, and I'm going to do it again. I'm going to read it again. I'm reading all the swipes you told me to read." I mean, I don't know where this guy is now. I'm expecting 5 to 10 years from now, whoever he is, he's going to come back to me and tell me I gave him his copy of Breakthrough Advertising, and it skyrocketed his career, or I won't hear from him again, and that's okay too.
Now, let me give you and this is a hilariously diverse discussion we're having, which I like. Something you might want to do parenthetically is have someone read those books and do audios on them. And you can
I'm going to do the Breakthrough Advertising audio. I'm going to do the reading of it.
Yeah, you should have it pre-sold because I don't think people realize how powerful that is. But also, it's a very dense book. So let's continue, because there's so much to cover, so little time, so little, you know, it's raining. It's not raining men, it's raining. It's raining direct response brilliance. Okay. So you illustrated and dimensionalized the big lesson in the beginning. So now your career is moving. You moved from list management to a much more elevated role of sort of being the strategist, the guiding force, the revenue generator, the everything. So let's talk about distinctions that you made that incorporate a parallel universe. Universe one is maximizing, managing, multiplying success. And whether it's doubling up, whether it's understanding lifetime value, whether it's having back ends, whether it's all the above, none of the above. And then secondly, managing the resources necessary to precipitate and perpetuate the growth. So it's a dual question.
So I think what I heard there and what resonated in my head as you were talking were two things. You said lifetime value. I'm gonna say that understanding what Dick Benson called the bogey, B-O-G-E-Y, was one of the most important lessons, which is a lifetime value lesson, which was how much can I afford to lose in year one to make it back in year two? Or how much can I lose in years one and two to make it back by year three? And having this long view of the customer and not the quick hit was obviously mind expanding for me and for Marty, and we spent days and months and years lamenting about the days where we didn't have the cash flow to mail as much as we could because we were how much we knew we were willing to lose, but we didn't have the cash to mail that as much as we wanted to because we knew we were going to make it back. So that's like a big, big concept of you know, how much can I afford to lose to make it back? And whatever criteria you use, you must use that criteria and not be a greedy pig thinking I've got to make money on everything that I do immediately. But then you talked about harnessing the resources. And the thing that just pounded in my head as soon as you said that was what a privileged life I've had that I've worked closely with Jim Rutz, Gary Bensavenga, you know, the great writers of today that are our buddies, Paris Lampropoulos and David Deutsch and Arthur Johnson and Eric Betchel and Clayton Makepeace and Jim Punkrey, and I'm going to forget like one of the greats or many of the greats now. And these copywriters, Marty and I had this abundant mindset that there was a select group of people that, you know, we said before that the medium probably was more important than the copy, but Marty and I knew that to exponentially grow the business to the 150 million from the 3 or 4 million that it was when I got there, the only way to do that was to invest heavily in world-class resources. So that included the best list brokers, it included the best printers and the ones that could get us the best prices and, you know, the best formats. But you know what? Even though copy might have been less important because I could use not world-class copy and still make money, by investing in the Gary Bensavengas and Jim Rutzes of the world and paying them as much as, you know, where there were years, and I am so proud to admit this, I wear it like a badge of honor, that there were years that Gary Bensavenga, Jim Rutz, other copywriters, the checks that Marty and I sent to them in a single year eclipsed what Marty and I took as salaries. And we were so proud of it. And I remember the day that our CFO came in one day and said, and I think it was about a check for maybe $1,100,000 in royalties to a copywriter. I think it was for Gary Bensavenga. And I wasn't Gary's only client, remember. So it's $1,100,000 in royalties for one control package from maybe two mailings he did. The CFO comes in to Marty and I, we're sitting in Marty's office, and he goes, what's this? How can we send out $1,100,000 to Gary Bensavenga for royalties when, you know, I make this and you make that and blah, 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 blah. And Marty and I would have none of it. And we looked at him and says, do you realize that control package, what that's made us, what it's worth to us as an organization, what it means to have Gary Ben, this goes back now to the lifetime value, what it means to have Gary Bensavenga write a control for us, that's a bookalog, a 64-page bookalog, which is a 64-page promotion, that the people that come in from that promotion are the most, have the highest lifetime value that we've ever had in any new subscribers. And it's not just the $1,000,001 he made and the $5 million we made in year one. It's the $20, $30, $40 million over the lifetime that we're going to make in renewals, because the person that came in was so suited to be a customer that would stay with us for 3, 4, and 5 years. Now, what Bensavenga has done is set the groundwork, because I'm not paying him a royalty on renewals. I'm just paying him a royalty on the upfront acquisition. And the interesting thing is that when Marty and I used to look at the P&Ls for the company, and we'd look at the book sales, and we'd look at the new subscriptions, and we'd look at the renewals, and we'd look at whatever other products we did, and you looked at where the most of the money was coming in, Marty turned to me one day, he says, Brian, do you know what business we're in? I said, I think we're in the subscription and book business. He goes, well, you're close. We're in the business of Bottom Line Personal, which was our flagship newsletter, which got to 1 million subscribers. We're in the business of Bottom Line Personal renewals. And if you look at the renewal income, which we didn't have to pay new acquisition costs on, you know, Jay and I, you know, you and I both know, Jay, that you know, the cost to get to keep a customer is so much less than to get a new one. And so when you start putting all of those numbers into big spreadsheets, we didn't even have the computer systems that we had later on, and we realized that we were in the business of bottom line renewals. What was the $1,000,001 check to Gary Bensavenga? It was like a, it's a big chunk of money, but it basically was the foundation that the entire company was built on because of the bogeys, because of lifetime value, because of bringing in quality subscribers up front instead of quantity of subscribers up front. And the quality of those subscribers were because of the promotion that they came in on. And that's how I analyzed every list I ever mailed. This goes back to my list education. When I used to mail other people's lists, the first thing I asked for was, what was the promotion that got the name? I wanted to see, besides the fact that I wanted to know how much they spent and what the product was, what was the promotion that got that name on that other person's list, so I could see the psychology of those buyers or subscribers. And I got to tell you, if Gary Bensavenga was writing a control for Agora or one of the other companies, and that was their list, I knew that that list was going to work for me. Because now, if the same, think about that, that I was doing list selection based on the copywriter who wrote the promotion that got the name on the other list.
That's brilliant.
Nobody thought like that. And that's why Marty and I were always a step ahead. And that's why list selection, going back full circle, was still involved in this analysis of lifetime.
But also, what
analysis of creative.
Yeah, but you also imputed, there's a neat word that I just lost. You imputed attribution, who created that list.
Correct. What was the philosophy, the psychology? I mean, you know, being having Gene Schwartz as a mentor and as a friend, I mean, how cool is that? I mean, how cool is it that I have Jay Abraham as a mentor and a friend? That's just as cool.
I think Gene was,
and you're still here.
I was exposed to his mind, and it was mammoth.
Mammoth. But you know what? I'm not just saying this because we're on this call together. You mean as much to me in my life as Gene did. But what Gene gave to me, he was so freaking brilliant on this particular topic of the psychology of your customer. You know, he used to say just simple shit like, you know, there is your customer. There is the language that your customer knows and speaks in and listens to. I mean, this is what our buddy Michael Fishman always talks about, right? You speak in the language of your audience, of your customer. And it's so simple, and Gene made it sound so elegant and so simple, and yet to do it at the level that he did it at, and the level that Bensavenga did it at, and the level that Jim Rutz did it at, you know, I marveled at it. And, you know, so I think the two things, I think I answered your question in some respect about that it was the combination of lifetime value and then this incredibly abundant mindset to make sure that we were paying top dollar for world-class creative that was only possible from a handful of copywriters. You and I both know that even in the 80s when we met and we were talking about all those financial publishers, you know, Agora and Howard Ruff and, you know, Martin Weiss, and, you know, there were all these growing, I mean, it was just a hotbed of you know, Bob Kephart, and, you know, you and I could go on and on about these amazing, Tom Phillips. And so much of their success was based on the fact that they, too, were slaves to list selection and segmentation. I mean, Tom Phillips used to actually have to approve every list that Phillips Publishing mailed, and he was the president of a $200 million business. And yet, they hired only the best copywriters. I mean, they had an internal guy, Richard Stanton Jones, that his standards for what copy would pass muster for Phillips to mail was incredible. Just like Marty, you know, Marty was like, it's such a demand for excellence, and that I got to work next to that for 30 some odd years. You know, how privileged was I?
Okay. Now I'm going to stop you, and I'm going to make some interpretations. And I also want to say you did answer part one, but you did not answer part two, but stay in abeyance because I want to give you some impressions, okay?
Okay.
So what I heard you say was that if you don't recognize whatever you want to call it, the back end, the residual, the recurring element of the business, and you're one shot oriented, or you don't factor in how valuable, profitable that is, you really are failing to grasp the whole magnitude of this whole wonderful business. Number two, what you said was very interesting because, excuse me, what I learned long ago was if you can see the correlation and you can predictably demonstrate worst case outrageous yield for funding your back end, meaning your loss on acquisition and your recoupment and then your massive profit on subsequent either renewals or product sales or service sales, you can get almost any investor to fund, particularly if you do it in slow increments. And most people don't realize if an investor is getting whatever, 8%, 6%, right, give them 12 or 15 because you don't really care. You just factor it in as a cost of sales. You just have to go after it. Most people think they don't have cash, but plus there's a lot of alternative ways to do it with. So that's another thing. Speaking of an investor, what you said was you were always not a marketer as much as an investor in the future asset value of a buyer. I'm just telling you what I heard. Maybe not. One second. One of the things, and most people don't understand it, but I'll tell you a story, but it's not, again, an ADD moment. Back in the late 70s, 80s, there were only three or four great copywriters, Benzavinga, Rutz, you name them. And I actually wasn't a great copywriter, but I was very successful. And I never did it for a fee. I was the only one back then.
I tried to get you to write a package for me. You wouldn't do it.
Well, it was no money in it. I mean,
right, exactly. You understood scalable businesses, and that wasn't one of them, except if you were, you know, them.
Well, but I always took a percentage of the profit.
Yes.
Or the gross. And Gary Benzavinga, funny story, Gary Benzavinga at the time was charging $8,000 or $9,000 buyout, and he was killing it. And I went to him, I think I told you, and I said, I will give you $4,000 up front. We'll own the piece together. We'll lease it for a nickel or whatever percent we can get. You get not just the difference, but I'll give you double the difference and then we'll split, and he wouldn't do it. And I was doing that all day long. And not only was I doing it, I never had an exclusive. I could reuse the copy in all kinds of different ways.
I think he came around closer to your model much later on.
He did. Oh, yeah. He did great with it. But I realized this when I started selling it. Now, I'm using this that was a little tangential. But most people they default to mediocrity because of the front end cost. They
right.
don't look at it in the right context. I always looked at it in behalf of myself or whether I was advising a client on anybody great, that it is not an expense, it's a cost of sales. And every time you have to pay it, it's because that person made you such a multiple, either front end, back end, both. And it's a different mindset. Let me continue. You made a point, and I have a similar scenario. Back in 1978, I earned $2 million from one client. It was investment rares. That was good money in 78. And Jim Cook was probably making 350. When he started, he was only making 50, but his controller was the same thing. It was, this guy's making too much money. And he, to his credit, he said he's making us all the money we're making, and he's only getting paid on this. We own the business. It's a very different. It's a different.
I'll tell you, but there's a scarcity mindset. I saw it throughout my career, even in people when they were seeing what we were doing in Agora and Philips, they still didn't have that mindset. And you hear it today all the time. Oh, we're not doing royalties anymore. We're not giving people a piece of the action. And these are the same people that say, "Oh, my partners, my vendors are my partners." They are so full of shit. You know, you have to walk the walk. I mean, you can say all you want that your vendors are your partners, but if they're really your partner, then you give them a piece of the action and they're that valuable. And you taught me that, God, that you're one of the first people that taught me that, Jay.
Well, thank you. But there's an irony there too. Most of the people in the organization are bonused and rewarded for results. So yeah. There's a hypocrisy at the highest level. Let me go.
Total hypocrisy.
Let me continue. One of the best quotes I ever heard was Tom Phillips at one of our programs, and it was profound, and I've remembered it for 20 some years. Hire the best and cry only once. And it's pretty profound if you think.
That is profound.
So let me give you a couple more comments because I wrote them down. Oh, you know, when I started in 78, I got Jace Revell, who was the publisher of Entrepreneur Magazine, to get me an allocation of $15,000 to hire Dan Rosenthal for one day of orientation. And he thought I was crazy. And it was the best investment I ever made.
Yeah, he was key. What a mind.
And it was just, it changed my whole philosophy. I've got two more things. 1 second.
Yeah, but I mean, you're just like, it's great because you have such a great history of never having a scarcity mindset, always thinking about, you know, how can I leverage this? I mean, a day doesn't go by that I don't use the quote, getting everything you can out of all you've got, which is the title of one of your books. And you live, so you have, but you have to suspend yourself. It's sort of like, you know, I just heard the other day, I won't mention the name, but a big direct marketer had always paid royalties and all of a sudden decided on an edict from on high, we're not paying royalties anymore. It's too much money. Well, you've been in business for X amount of decades. Do you think you got there with a scarcity mindset? I don't get it. I don't get it.
It's a terrible irony. And then I was looking at a compensation formula that somebody sent somebody, and they were asking me for a perspective. And instead of being rewarded in a almost an asymmetric way, they were punitive as they got higher and higher. And I'm thinking, what kind of idiot owns a business and says, okay, at $1 million, you get 2%. But at $5 million, I'm only going to give you 1% above the million. And what is that incentive? I mean, because everything about that extra $4 million is infinitely more profitable.
Like the margin is everything. It's just weird. And so you asked the question about building a business
for young people. Okay, a couple young, and to me is under 50, by the way. A couple more points, and then we'll go on. You named a litany of what I'll call modern day copywriting iconic geniuses. I would like you to take a deep breath, go back and name as many as you can, and the one biggest lesson you learned from or you observed about each one.
Okay.
The easiest is Gary Bensavinga.
Yeah, Gary Bensavinga. The thing that I learned, you'll find this interesting, it was actually, you know, how can someone be that competitive and that humble at the same time? And basically how the tenaciousness of being like the nicest guy in the world, but that understanding his craft at such a deep level. That I always say this about Gary, the day that he got a control package for us was the day he tried to beat it. Like, he'd be damned if he was going to let someone else come and beat him. Now, if someone else beat him, he'd be the first one to say, oh, Jim Rutz is amazing. Clayton Makepeace is phenomenal. You know, he was like so quick to basically tell. And I remember once I made some comment in an interview that, you know, I think I might have used the word Gary was cutthroat, or I don't know what words I used. And he actually called me and scolded me, and rightly so, because he said, Brian, I'm not out there to just beat it. You make me sound like some guy who all I want to do is, like, you know, eat the competition alive. And that's not who I am. I want to do the best I can do, but I'm actually standing on the shoulders of them because they're inspiring me to be better because they set the bar so high.
It's brilliant. So,
that is like an amazing lesson when you're talking about probably, I think right now I would say that he's not writing anymore except for his own olive oil business, but he's probably the best living copywriter right now.
I agree with you.
I mean, everybody who is alive today writing copy would probably, in fact, at the Titans event, if you recall, Gary spoke, and then my my Mount Rushmore panel spoke, which were the four copywriters who did 650 million pieces for me.
Yes.
And all four of them said, this was unbelievable, but I just got to hear Gary speak again. So just to give
you... I adore him. And I don't know him that well, but he and I have a very, I think, a quality respect for each other.
Yeah, you do. He's a big admirer of yours.
Yeah, and vice versa. So
Gary, that was my big lesson from Gary. Gene Schwartz, I mean, Gene Schwartz, for a guy, I mean, God, the power of reading. You know, when I was in college, I was an English major, so all I read was fiction and whatever. And I got out of college, and Marty Edelston looked at me and said, fiction's a waste of time. You know, you really want to spend all your time reading nonfiction and business books, because that's how we're going to build the business. And I drank that Kool-Aid, and it served me well. You know, I read all the great nonfiction books. I read all the great marketing books. And then I started spending more time with Gene, and I went into his library, and I realized, you know, A, his favorite magazine was National Enquirer, because he needed to understand what modern culture was up to, again, this goes back to the crowd. This goes back to Gary Halbert, right, with the starving crowd. But Gene understood this at such a core level that he wasn't the magician copywriter. He was the guy that was fulfilling the needs. I mean, what is the in the introduction to Breakthrough Advertising? I think he said it's not a matter of building bigger mouse traps. It's actually build your mice that terrify people and then writing about it or something like that. He understood that paranoia was something that you don't want to scare people unnecessarily, but he understood that people were scared. You have to understand that. So if you don't understand that, you can't be a great writer, because you're not going to be able to tap into those desires and those fears and all of those things. So anyway, the power of reading. And so Gene turned me around. Even though I stopped reading fiction after college, I started realizing that I was probably missing the boat if I really wanted to be a world-class copywriter, because you have to read everything. You have to know what modern culture is all about. And at your peril, you will fail as a marketer and a copywriter if you don't understand what people are feeling. I'm not political at all, but I will tell you that if you study the language of Donald Trump during this election, you will see someone who understood what the crowd wanted, what they wanted to hear, how he would message that. I mean, I think I said in one comment somewhere that Gary Halbert, whether he would have been for Trump or not, it's irrelevant. He would have said, boy, talk about, you know, speaking in language that everybody can understand and hear. So anyway, Gene Schwartz, the lesson was that while he had this incredible depth of knowledge of everything, he was like a student of science. He was a student.
And beautiful,
of art.
He knew art.
Yeah.
And he was a wine connoisseur.
Oh man! I mean, in fact, his obituary, if you read it, you can find it online from the New York Times. There's one paragraph about his direct marketing and copywriting prowess. The rest of it is all about his incredible art collection and being one of the top collectors of modern art in the world and known in New York circles for making or breaking artists with his wife, Barbara. So an eclectic personality like that, who actually had this incredible skill as a copywriter, boy, what a freaking lesson that was. In like, you know, I couldn't help but be with him and not feel like a slacker, but not in terms of being beat myself up about it, but to feel so privileged and grateful to be around that and to learn the value of that. So that was my Gene Schwartz thing. Jim Rutz, you know, Jim Rutz, the biggest lesson was like, I don't give a shit what people think of me, think of my copy. I am going to go full bore in what I think is what's best, and I'll edit back from there. And in fact, you know, his sister and I, his sister Ginger and I was had the honor of getting all of his swipes. He really trusted me, and he became a really close friend. And basically, I'm putting together a product, you know, the Lost Files of Jim Rutz. I'm working with three young copywriters.
That's great.
Came out of the woodwork to help me put together this swipe file of all of Jim's work and all of the work that Jim admired the most. Then I'm going to interview all the people like David Deutsch who worked as an apprentice under Jim Rutz. Anyway, the lesson that I learned from him is, you know, first of all, that whole thing about swipe files as furniture, you know, but he didn't give a damn about whether he was politically correct in his copy. And he let his sister Ginger kind of tone stuff down a little bit because he wasn't a racist. He wasn't a misogynist. He just knew that, I guess like Donald Trump knew, that there was certain language that people were going to respond to. And then we toned it down accordingly based on who the client was. And he used to get pissed off at us if we had to tone it down a little bit. But he also knew what was going to work. The other thing that he did that I'm noticing now going through all of his swipe files is that he tested against himself in the weirdest ways. I mean, he probably had more losers than any copywriter, any great copywriter I've ever seen in my life. You know, Gary Bensavenga I used to marvel at the fact that I think his success rate was somewhere in the, he said it was 85%. I think it was closer to 90% where he would get the control if he got the assignment. Jim might have had some of that. You know, he might have had some of that, you know, success rate, but he also had this incredible failure rate because he was testing like crazy against his own stuff all the time. And he tested some batshit crazy stuff. And, you know, so it was almost like I'd rather have a strikeout or a home run than hit a bunch of singles. And what an amazing way to live life, right? I mean, and that's why he lost millions and he made millions and he gave his money to the school that he started for wayward youth in Nebraska. You know, he did a Bible school and he did a bunch of stuff and he couldn't hold on to money.
And he was charismatic in a, he was wickedly nonconformist.
Wickedly nonconformist is actually the words I would have been looking for, but he was like, he couldn't hold on to money, sort of like Halbert.
Yeah.
You know, they just couldn't, you know, he always was, I'll tell you a quick little story just about abundance and all that. So yeah. Jim Rutz had done so much for Boardroom for so many years. I think I might've told this story in a blog once, but he did so many things for Boardroom over so many years and made us millions about, you know, tens of millions of dollars over years and years of stuff. And he would charge anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 for a package plus royalties. And he came to Marty and I late in his career and he, a little bit of hat in hand, and he said, Brian, Marty, I'm out of money. I put it all into the school and I want to write you a package, but I need $100,000. And like within like, without blinking, you know, Marty wrote out a check for $100,000 to Jim Rutz for the package, whatever it would be. He didn't even know what product it was going to be for. And I looked at Marty and I said, boy, you just taught me an incredible lesson, Marty. And he said, I hope so, Brian, because the CFO will be in here any minute saying what an idiot I am. But the basic premise there was, I said, Marty, you don't even care if he writes a winner, do you? He goes, absolutely not. I care about Jim Rutz, that he was a partner in our business, that we're a $100 million business to a large degree because of people like him. And if he writes me a winner for the $100,000, great. If he doesn't, chances are he'll try a second time because he's going to feel bad. And I don't want him to feel bad. But whatever it is, I don't really care whether he gets a winner or not. And I remember our creative director at the time was like, really like annoyed because like, how could you do this? And then he wrote a package that was a big loser for that $100,000. And she wanted to do like a whole I told you so to Marty and I. And I said, don't you dare. Don't you dare.
It's, no, that's powerful. Are you still there?
I'm still there. It's like, I was just thinking about it. I just shed a tear. I'm sorry.
No, I understand totally. No,
you know, because like Jim called me almost in tears when, you know, we Federal Express that $100,000 check. I remember the phone call. It was like, and I remember him telling me, shortly before he died, when I tried to get him to come to the Titans event as my guest and he couldn't travel, and he again teared up on the phone, and Marty was already gone by then, obviously, and he goes, that guy was like, you know, one of the gems of the earth, and I feel the same way.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, let's continue, because I want to plumb your mind. I want to mine your mind. I want to really...
I love the way that though you're interpreting some of the stuff and taking it to like a different angle, which is great.
I'm making copious notes, but continue on your run, because you're doing good.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think, who else would I say...
Okay, well, who else wrote for you? Let's think. Clayton, did Clayton write?
Yeah, Clayton. Now, Clayton, I'm still very much in touch with. In fact, you're going to see Clayton in our next mastermind meeting, because you're coming as a guest, and so is he.
Okay.
And the thing I learned from Clayton is that he and this is not saying if this comes off as me saying that he had any laziness, it's not at all. Clayton was such a student of the greats that I profile in my book. I mean, I'm talking about Hopkins and Caples, and he studied everything, and he had this ability to take a convention from another era and another copywriter and another copy platform and make it his own. I was just always flabbergasted at no one could steal smarter than Clayton, but he wasn't really stealing because, you know, another copywriter would be like, you know, patting themselves on the back about what they just invented. And Clayton would be like, I didn't invent that, but, you know, I knew how to adapt that to your product based on what I've learned. And he also, he's able to pick, like you, Jay, he's able to pick apart other people's brains in a way. So it's not just the great books of people who are dead. It's also the people who are still alive. And I just saw a presentation he gave at AWAI, and it was slides of people who were all alive, all practicing, either copywriters or marketers. And he was talking about all the lessons that he had learned from them and how he adapts it to his copy. So that's a great lesson too. You know, that's someone who, you have to have a big ego to be a great copywriter. But you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to walk around with hubris and walk around not wanting to be on the shoulders of giants as well. And Clayton taught me that you can stand on the shoulders of giants and be a giant at the same time. I just love that about him.
It's fabulous. Let me think of who else would have written for you that was...
Jim Punkrey was an interesting one. Jim Punkrey, I think, was a copywriter who personified the power of niche, the power of niching down and being so good at one thing. Like, he was good at, he could write up for us on a lot of different things, but when he was in his element in the health niche and he started digging down into some area of health, and in particular, I mean, he created a whole franchise for us in the diabetes niche at Boardroom, and he did the same for Rodale for many years. And I just think that if you follow Jim Punkrey's career when he was probably the number one health copywriter in the world, it was because he understood that, why should I be writing about stuff that I'm not passionate about, that I haven't taken a deep dive in? You know, he understood how powerful it was to be writing within a passion and a niche. So that was a great lesson, and it's one that I teach all young copywriters today when they ask me my opinion on the things that they need to have in their arsenal to become great. And it's not just the 10,000 hours, and it's not just having a great, you know, client base and samples, and it's not just reading a lot like Gene, but it's also having passion. I think Dean Graziosi, who's a wonderful marketer today, has this quote that says, you know, if you don't love what you're writing about or what you're doing, go do something else. So that was Jim.
That's good. Anyone else come to mind? Didn't have to.
Yeah, no, but I you know, the current writers, you know, the Paris Lampropoulos, who's a good friend, and, you know, he was like the power of research. You know, I always tell the story about when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the urologist told me, you know, what the deal was and what my options were. My second call after that was to Paris, because I knew that he had done every package that was the best package I ever read on alternative treatments for prostate cancer. And it's to trust a copywriter more than I would trust a doctor to at least give me the scoop of what he learned, because I knew how powerful he researched everything. So that was a great lesson I learned from Paris. David Deutsch, who's a buddy of ours and another copywriter, one of my best friends, he was like, and still is, I mean, the power of every word, you know, that's why his copy was always late, because he was so meticulous. And every time I write a blog post, you know, he writes me a critique of my blog post. And I love that, you know, and I say to David, you know, I'm not going to be insulted. I know you're going to insult me, but I'm not going to be insulted. Because I really think that you are just so, you know, you just trust your, you know, the every word that, you know, is just so important. You know, Arthur, I could go on. I mean, there are just so many.
That's good. Now let me give you some interpretations. Hold on.
Oh, Bill Jamie is another one.
And what'd you learn from him?
Bill was, he was about culture. I guess similar to, you know, Gene reading the National Enquirer, you know, Bill Jamie could write for almost any consumer magazine in any category, which most copywriters never could. And like, he could write for a cookie magazine.
So readable.
So he understood narrative, and he understood pop culture. And there wasn't a piece of pop culture that he didn't enjoy reading about, learning about. Yeah, that was amazing that he could be that.
So let me make a bunch of, a few comments, okay? And I got to go through my notes, because first of all, they're not in order, but you said something about research, and I was influenced by Claude Hopkins. I'm one of the people that'll read 10,000 pages looking for a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And most people want to just knock right through it, and they don't even really want to go more than veneer, superficial. That's one thing. The idea of reading the National Enquirer, I basically would read every, I would send people out to, I wouldn't buy them. I would send people out and pay them when we had bookstores to get all the cover headlines and the inside story topic lines for everything from Cosmo, Inquirer, every kind of magazine of any kind, because most people don't realize that those copywriters, those headline writers are being paid 500 grand to write those headlines.
Absolutely.
They're the difference between people picking up the magazine or rejecting it. And those headlines have been tested and work really well. We send you headlines. I have a full-time guy that just goes through everything from AOL, Huffington Post, Red State, all those things, looking for provocative headlines.
Yeah, I think people who write in the editorial environment, you're absolutely right. There's like treasure all over that in terms of adapting for, and Marty used to love cliches too. So when you see a headline, even in a newspaper, that's kind of working off a cliche, you can actually create headlines in your promotion copy, because people recognize that stuff and it vibrates with them.
It's true. You talked about Gene Schwartz diversity. And I think if I have any great gift, it's that I understand more things and more variants on more things than most people, because I force myself to be interested in everything. And if you study creativity, it's a very critical form. Most of these people don't really want to transcend. They don't want to go wide, nor do they really want to go deep enough. And it's very interesting. I'm just making a...
Yeah, that's a very, very astute, very astute.
Yeah, you talked about love what you're doing, and I would not amend it, but I believe you have to love who you're doing it for and what doing means to them. And you have to be able to appreciate, understand, respect, and empathize for what their life is like. And I think that's a big void as well. Hold on. You made a point about Clayton, which I think is really important, and that is that there's no shame in adapting, adopting, modeling, extrapolating, reconstituting, as long as you're not literally lifting it. Because
stealing's a felony, stealing smart's an art.
Denny Hatch wrote something that we sent out, and it was that the first direct response came from, one of the churches back in the 1600s where they're burnt down and they had to send letters to the wealthy to try to persuade him to give money and come and help them rebuild it. And he was talking about there's nothing new, just new ways of expressing, articulating, or combining it. I believe.
Yeah, that was like the thing, as I said before, it was amazing to me that people don't see the value of swipe files. Anybody who doesn't see the value of swipe files is nuts.
You talked about Gary, and I think Gary is the one, but there's one of the, and I always did this, I always came up with five different ways to go at it, and I never tried to, my ego was never in it. I didn't care about myself. I cared about the outcome. And I think most people think they can knock it out with one approach, and some can, but it's very arrogant and ignorant not to want to hedge yourself, particularly given the fact that there are so many different, as you said, when you learned the different facets of female or conservative and how they responded to different hot buttons, I think that most of the great copywriters would at least create different openings. Maybe they would append them to the same body copy, but they would not allow themselves to put all their chips on black 13, for example.
Right.
A couple more things, and then we'll move on to, I got another really great question for you. One second. Hold on. Oh, shoot. I can't read my writing. That's the worst thing about it. Hold on one more second.
That's okay.
Bill Jamie, I have the rights, and I keep forgetting, I think I ought to put it out right away just as a gift to the world. I have that Denny Hatch million dollar mailings, and we got it scanned and cleaned up, and we're just sitting on it. And it's good because it's even though it's older, it goes into multiple perspectives because it interviews the company, the whoever was responsible for the project, the copywriter, the graphic person. It's pretty interesting. And I used to take, I really feel bad because I was manual. I had every one of those ads typed up and I would rewrite them the same way because they were great and they had certain phraseologies that were outrageous. Again, this goes to the how much, not work, how much investment are you willing to make for a greater outcome? I have a friend who is the number one man in Six Sigma, and Trump is so popular right now. My friend bought one of Trump's lots at one of the Trump golf courses by me. Right. And he bought it because he went to Donald Trump and he said, you stand for quality, but I'm going to show you what real quality is. And he was so painstaking in his fanaticism, not about its beauty, but about the quality of what he built, the construction, the logic. And I think most people want to just get the job done and be shortcuts. And I think that that's a tremendous disservice to yourself. It's a tremendous disservice to all the people your copy could impact if you made, I will write, I would, well, I don't write much anymore, but I'll write over and over and
right.
over again until it flows. And I used to do it manually because I never could do. And what would happen is if I came to an impasse, let's say I'm on page 3 of my yellow pad and it doesn't work, I would not sit down and try to come up with a way to alter that. I would start right back from the beginning because I felt like I hadn't taken it down the right path. Mm-hmm. And it was arduous. It was painful. And sometimes I'd have to do it 15 different ways to get it right, but we had billions of dollars of winners. And I think my embellishment of what you're saying is that I believe, everyone's looking for a silver bullet. And the truth of the matter, One time, Fran Tarkenton spoke at one of my seminars, and he talked about a concept called wrestling the bear to the ground every day. And the deal is, there's everyone's looking for the secret, and the secret is there is no secret.
Right, right.
You want to outperform, out achieve. You have to out invest and out think and out understand and out. I mean, you just have to. There's not. I mean, there's occasional luck, but it's not that. Let me continue. I'm almost done. Let's see. Oh, the one thing I think you talked about Gary wanting to immediately beat himself, and I think there's a quote from Peter Drucker, and he says, "Your obligation as an enduring enterprise is to constantly be committed to make your product, your service, your business model, your proposition obsolete. Because if you don't do it, you can be assured someone else will do it to you for you."
Yeah.
And I didn't say it with the elegance that he said it. But, I mean, the fact is, when you study optimization, which I have, and I've been trained by some masters, you realize that it's very rare that even the best winner is the quintessence, ultimate, whatever the word is. There's a better word for ultimate pinnacle, and I don't know what it is right now. But any complaint, you can be complacent. In The Sticking Point, which is one of our books, I made a point, and it evolved past that, that you can be successfully stuck and not know how much more is possible from front, back, you know, markets, copy, access, all these things. And there's a tragedy there if you are committed to rendering contribution and creating ultimate value for someone beyond and above your competitor. That's another long philosophical idea for discussion. But now I'm going to switch you, okay?
Go ahead.
Because you answered one question, but you really, you skirted or didn't hear, or I was rudely confusing on the other. Let's the confusion. I want to know what you've learned about the resources, the team, the expertise, the attributes, whether it's and extrapolate it today, because a lot of the technology and a lot of the outsourced services and a lot of the providers of different kinds of service and products that weren't available in the past shorten it, but there are, without the right infrastructure, without the right culture, without the right, you know, without, I don't believe you can be an enduring entity. I think there are a lot of people who are elongated promotions destined to be supernovas because they really don't understand what I'm asking you to comment on. So can you try to?
Yeah, I'll try. I mean, I think one of the things that popped into my head as you were saying that was one of the sort of like the secret sauce that got us where we got to. And I think a lot of it was being what I call a learning organization, which a lot of people have written about. I'm not the expert. I'm not a management consulting, you know, that kind of expert. But we did have an organization that, you know, giving the example we've already talked about. So a learning organization would be like if you've got a CFO who thinks we're making a stupid mistake to send a $1 million check to Gary Bensavenga. On the other hand, after we explain it in the context of our business philosophy, the CFO gets it. So the next check, they're saying, I can't wait to send this to Gary Bensavenga. That's the ongoing enterprise that Marty and I wanted to have, as opposed to, you know, disciplining employees and telling them they were wrong and telling them that they, you know, couldn't do this or couldn't do that. So it was the learning organization mentality. And then the other thing that Marty invented, and you mentioned Peter Drucker, you know, Marty invented a continuous improvement system based on Kaizen called iPower, which is a very, very simple continuous improvement system. And it was based on a meeting Marty had with Peter Drucker. Marty went to visit Peter Drucker. And he said, Peter, you know, our meetings stink at boardroom. I don't know what the objectives are going in. I don't know what the objectives are going out. I don't know what the action plan is, blah, blah, blah. And Peter just looked at him and says, just have everybody bring two ideas to every meeting. And what Marty then expanded to was that we needed thinking from every single level of the organization so that the story he tells in the iPower book is, you know, the person who's on the front lines in fulfillment figured out that if the book was, you know, a half an ounce less, you know, lighter, we would qualify for a different level of postage, and therefore it would save us a lot of money. And, you know, that was like a $300,000 idea by trimming the book size and the page size by, you know, a half an inch or something. And it wasn't anything that was a production nightmare at all. So that's the kind of stuff that you need to incorporate into your organization if you don't want to flame out. And a lot of entrepreneurs, unfortunately, and I've written about this, is like, you know, Marty had the wherewithal to have a second rainmaker. So I was lucky enough to be that guy, but he was always the first rainmaker, and I became the second rainmaker. Most entrepreneurs don't want a second rainmaker. They don't want to hear from other people's ideas. And look, Marty nixed a lot of my ideas. Marty was very, very tough on me. I think it made me as good as I am because he didn't give me an easy way to get everything that I wanted to do implemented. But it wasn't like I was dealing with my boss. I was dealing with, you know, my co-rainmaker. And he used to say to me all the time, you know, it's me and you, kid. You know, it's me and you if we're going to come up with new ideas. If he hated my new idea, I had to deal with it. I had to have some thick skin about it. But if I hated his idea, we still might do it because that's where, you know, someone's got the final vote, right? You know, this Trump White House with two chief of staffs, I don't know how that's going to work out because someone ultimately has to make a decision. But in that case, the president will, and it will be Trump. So in this case, Marty would make the decision. So I think the learning organization was a big, big part of it. And, you know, I think also some of the things we've hinted at with the outside, quote unquote, vendors, including copywriters, you got to let them in. You know, you got to let them in at a very, very deep level, at a very profound level. And you can't just talk the talk of partnership. You've got to walk the walk, and you've got to not just give them a percentage of what you're of the sales, but you have to like bring them in on meetings that you normally wouldn't bring an outsider in on. You'd bring them in on strategic planning that you normally wouldn't bring an outsider in on. So I think those are some of the things that, as I'm thinking
good.
About.
Those are good. So let me comment on that, and then we're going to continue down memory lane and forward to observation lane, okay? We're going to go to the observation deck of the Brian Kurtz, let's call it the mental skyscraper, and we're going to talk about what you see when you can see a million miles. So hold on a minute. So you talked about a learning organization, and I think that far too many people today do not invest enough in their team and themselves to attend the right kind or participate in the right kind of live or vicarious training. And I think that your advantage comes, I mean, I've been very lucky. When I work with a client, they have to share with me. I've had 300 experts, and it's almost, it's not laughable, it's wonderful. But for me to help a Tony Robbins, or when I did the Deming organization, or when I do anybody, they have to first summarize and teach me their methodology, their ideology, their philosophy, you know, what they've learned and what they are trying to teach, so that I can rearticulate it, so that I can extol it, so I can revere it, so I can dimensionalize it, so I can animate it. So I get this massive education in so many integrative elements of either skills, technique, insight, mindset, strategy, tactics, but I don't think most people really want or recognize. My whole life, I realize, has been dedicated to finding the ultimate leverage in every action, effort, opportunity, day, and because for selfish reasons, because many activities, even if you improve them, they're going to be they're going to give you a linear outcome. There are certain things you do right, you're going to get an exponential, and you want to operate always in that range. Speaking of that, there's research that shows that the vast majority of team members only perform at 20% of their capacity, and it's not their fault. If they knew how to be superstar performers, they would. They need training, development, somebody who wants to invest to make them so great. Even if they leave before they leave you, your yield for the same salary, once you get them past, you know, their limited knowledge or capacity, can be five times more per person, or stated different, they can do the work of four more people if you really understood that. I've always found, and you hit on it, but I think there's something that is solely misunderstood by most people just trying to market stuff, particularly online. You do need a culture, and the culture is that everyone and everything, everyone involved with you and everything you do, internally, externally, marketing, communication, you have to really be on a mission, a crusade that is clearly understood and shared by everybody. Or you can still make money, but you're gonna sub-optimize. Next thing is your book, iPower. I loved the simplicity of that book. Do you still have that available, or is they still?
I do. I mean, Boardroom still has the copyright, but I was given. I bought a bunch of copies from Boardroom.
That's a great book,
and I give it away to people who want
great
it.
Great book.
Yeah.
One of the other things you hit on it, and it's a real failure of most. What I'll call newer entrepreneurs of all kinds, but certainly online or direct response, no matter, is that they have a failure to creatively collaborate. And the truth of the matter is that no one person has the capacity to grasp the magnitude of all that's going on in every facet. And the more you collaborate and evaluate carefully and examine all kinds of other either pieces of the puzzle or perspectives on it, the more well-reasoned and effective you can be if you understand critical thinking. And that's a whole nother thing. But I also believe one of the books that I co-authored, it's called The CEO Who Can See Around Corners. We don't even aggressively sell it, but it's quite intense. And it talks about larger companies needing to create internal masterminds where they really respect and mine all the perspectives of their people. One more thing.
Almost. Yeah, that's the whole thing about letting people out, you know, and letting them share. I told a story just recently about Reader's Digest. The story, I mean, people on this who are listening to this might not even know who Reader's Digest was. But when I came into business, they were the pinnacle of direct marketing success. And in the when I got into the business in the 1980s, already decided that, you know, their shit didn't stink, and they were their Reader's Digest and you're not. And yep. So they wouldn't come to the Direct Marketing Association conferences and share. They thought that their proprietary system for database marketing and what they were doing on their big mainframes, which was state of the art at the time, was not to share with anybody. And, you know, I think that whatever you call it, whether it's bad karma or whether it's, you know, share, that's fair, or whether it's, you know, all boats rise when you are setting the bar high, so other people will set the bar higher. They didn't share, and they're the ones that went bankrupt, and they were selling off their artwork for cash flow reasons. So I think they've gone bankrupt twice. I don't know what the new iteration of Reader's Digest is, but I guess my point is, it's not like I'm like, you know, relishing in their demise, but the fact is that the company that was, it's Kodak, right? I mean, someone within Kodak invented the digital camera, and, you know, and my daughter goes to grad school near Rochester, and, you know, that town didn't have to be a ghost town, you know, or not that it's a ghost town, but didn't have to be, you know. Kodak could have still been an amazing company, you know, owning that town. And so I just think that, you know, people don't see past their nose sometimes. They think that And you just said it before about, and you talk about this in your concept of preeminence, I think, too, that, you know, and I think Richard Koch talks about this, you know, being number two in a big category is probably not half as satisfying and interesting as being number one in a small one, and then staying number one in a small one. And so being number one in a big one is obviously the best, but, you know, it's just, people really miss the boat, I think, on this whole concept of all boats rise when you share your wisdom. Yeah, and and sending your people out to the right events, as you said.
You have to be a student and a teacher all the time.
All the time.
And so,
oops.
It's all right.
I've got to turn that off.
Yeah, it's okay. I turned mine off.
Yeah. So I think we've gone almost like over an hour and a half, so we better be careful because people won't listen to the end, although I think we've been incredibly stimulating.
So let's bring it to a conclusion. Okay? And we can do more at another time. So I have overstayed my visit, but I think the intrusion and the rudeness was worth it.
You weren't rude.
But, well, let's say this. I hope and I pray that everyone listening stops at intervals listening to this and reflects beyond just the words and thinks about the implications. The last question, sweet, I will ask you is very simple but very profoundly appropriate for the conclusion of this, for this discussion. Okay, you are looking and working with and at the current flock of online, offline direct marketers. What do you admire most about them? What do you wish that they learned and did differently? And what's the biggest summary wish that you want to leave everybody on this discussion with? And you can interview me at another one because we've overstayed our visit. So let's go right to that. What do you admire about the people you're seeing now that they represent, do see that is really good? What do you wish they did more of? Where are the flaws or the don'ts that you wish they would correct?
Okay, well, let's do one at a time. So the thing I admire most is that the ones who are doing it the best, the ones who are marketing online the best, they're an abundant mindset. They understand that they can give away their best content, something that you've always talked about. They understand that if they give away their best content, it's not their best because they have more to come. And whatever comes next will be the best. And the idea of they understand over-delivery of content and product and service. They understand that customer service and fulfillment are marketing functions, and that if your returns and your dissatisfaction rate goes up, you need to immediately abort something and change something because it's all about the long haul. And they're also, the thing I admire most is that they really understand the power of niche. They understand that, you know, trying to be, you know, the big fish in a big pond, let's not go there. Let's just try to be the big fish in a small pond. But even if it's a medium-sized fish in a small pond, the fact that we can just own a niche, we can own some piece of a niche, we can not try to be all things to all people because we're so good at this one thing and we're so passionate about this one thing, those are the best marketers. They're also the ones that are probably their own copywriters because there's no one better to write about what they're completely passionate about than them. So the ones I like the best are the ones, I mean, Ramit would be a good example, you know. Ramit Sethi is, you know, owning that category of millennials. He writes in a language they understand. He obviously is passionate about it. And he hires copywriters, but ultimately he's the best copywriter. So, you know, there's just a lot of just good stuff going on because of the ability to deliver content inexpensively, especially. So that's what I like best, I think, the combination of giving away your best stuff, feeling good about it, and niche and owning categories and being totally passionate. What was the second one? What I don't like?
Well, what you see weak. Well, you can say it any way.
I think it's create. I think it's like underestimating how much they exponentially the business could grow if they really were slaves to world-class creative, that they understand affiliates and getting the right list. They understand offers. You know, the best guys are certainly creating funnels that are just beyond belief, and they can get all kinds of back-end sales and get you into all kinds of stuff and get into higher ticket product. They get all that. But I think that they underestimate sometimes the intelligence of the reader, and they're not willing to invest in copywriting to the degree that they could. The ones that I do respect the most are investing a little bit more than most. And a lot of them are actually coming to me and saying, Brian, who do I go to next? And those are the people that then join my mastermind group. And then we work together to find more world-class copywriters for them or grow them. I mean, I'm committed because of you, a big part, Jay, that my up-and-coming mastermind group, of which your son is going to be a member, is the group that I want to train to be the next generation of great marketers and great copywriters. So, but I think the underestimating of the power of story copy and investing and paying for it. Like I think that they'll pay an affiliate 50% for media, but they won't pay a world-class copywriter an extra $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 and a piece of the action to take the company to the next level.
Yeah, I think that's a good piece. I have two comments that we'll stop for today, and we can always continue if the demand or the interest is there. I forgot to ask you, because you were very masterful. Whenever you collaborated with a world-class copywriter, you didn't make them have to work as hard. You prepared for them enormous, whatever you want to call it, preparatory packages.
Yeah, we called it the Project Start or Goodie Bag, whatever.
Why don't you share what you'd give them, and then I have one more point, and you can comment on it. When I was doing a lot of front-end stuff for people, I was always surprised. I always did everything. I did the back-end too, but I'd look at everybody and see them spend a fortune when they got into this awareness of a Gary Benzavinga on the acquisition, then go to a hack. Once they already had the trust, they'd go to a hack to write the back end, which is potentially cost nothing. It just was amazing. You talk for a minute, and somebody's at my front door. Here I come. Hold on.
So I'm going to talk while Jay's answering the door. So basically, I think that the Project Start, you know, giving the copywriter all the tools they need to do their best work is more than just showing them what the control package is that they have to be and giving them the product. Gene Schwartz had a wonderful quote once, and he said, I don't write copy, I assemble it. And what I think Gene meant by that is that a lot of times what the client gives you is not everything that you need to do your best work. So the question is, I always say, what's on the cutting room floor? What if you're writing for a promotion for a book or an ebook or whatever, what are the things that didn't get into the book that someone might have nixed that might have been more exciting than what's in the book? What kind of questions can we ask the author or the person behind the product that, you know, you're great, Jay, at the Socratic method and getting people to like spill their guts by asking them more questions and more questions. And I think a copywriter should do that. So what I used to anticipate as much of that as I could when I developed the Project Start packages by giving the copywriters like all the questions that I thought they might ask, but I'm going to anticipate them before they ask them. So here's all the stuff that got rejected by medical people that we couldn't put into the newsletter or the book if it was a health product. Or certainly we give them all the list history, all the lists that worked, all the lists that didn't work, the selections that we took so they can get an understanding of that universe. The thing we talked about right at the outset, what mailing packages were responsible for getting those lists so the copywriter can look at what worked to these kinds of people. Should they use a certain format because of that? I certainly would want to take a look at the competitive marketplace. Whose lists do we use? And then what seems to be different and the same in the respective avatars? So we got a subtle, we got the obvious, you know, list history, packages that work, packages that didn't, you know, every test package that didn't work, we would send them with results. So all of that, and there was more, I just can't think everything off the top of my head.
You've done, the point you're making is you invested all the way through to dramatically enhance the probability that everyone would succeed, and you made it collaborative. You didn't want them to not know. You wanted to think for them so that you hoped that that wasn't even enough, that they'd think above and beyond that and teach you more by helping identify more impact points. I think only because we have gone so long, we should stop, and this can be to be continued. Let's call this the ultimate cliffhanger.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just so excited because I think this is like what we talked about today is so good to share with both of our tribes, which I think
it's wonderful. And I think that what emerged was very meaningful and very, very powerful, not terribly complex, but I think it represents a reality and a paradigm that many people never ever understand, think about, reflect on, or actuate. So I'm very pleased to have always told you that what resides in your brain is so meaningful that you need a forum. One more thing. I challenged you on your book, but I do want to say that your collaborative book has some wonderful fundamentals that are enduring, that are immutable, and that I personally use to cultivate, develop, and fuel my own ability to perform so high. And there's nobody that wouldn't benefit monumentally, whether you write copy or you hire copy. It's very, very valuable, and I think you're a remarkably important force in this industry, and people should recognize it and avail themselves of your brain, your mind, your products, your services, your private organizations. And I think I'm done for today.
Thank you, Jay. Coming from you, obviously, it's means so much. I do want to mention also that for your folks that, you know, all the things we talked about swipe files, about, you know, learning, you know, even with the book, with whatever flaws there might be, you know, the fact if they go to thelegendsbook.com, they get to download after they buy the book, which is really inexpensive on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever you want to buy it, and you send the receipt. You get those swipe files from those six legends, Caples, Ogilvy, Collier, Hopkins, Schwartz, and Halbert. And you get the videos and the scientific advertising, illustrated, annotated version. So I know that I over-delivered just like all the things we've talked about today in terms of giving people access to some stuff that they would not get access to if they didn't buy the book. Plus, they get the book as a checklist and all the things that, and I appreciate, you know, you wrote a blurb for the book and you were very, very generous. And but if they, again, my list knows about it. You know, the people on my list, if they haven't bought it already, then they should get off my list, I guess. But thelegendsbook.com is a place to go to get the book, to get the resources, and very, very consistent with what we've talked about today in terms of honoring the past, using the past into the present, into the future. So I'm very proud of that piece of it, and I'm very proud that, you know, that you would spend so much time with me today to do this kind of Socratic interview that was, on the one hand, you interviewing me, but, man, I'm going to go back and listen to it now and realize that, you know, the gems that you put into this interview makes this an interview that, even though my list might be sick of me, they ain't going to be sick of you, and I'm going to make sure that they got the interviews you did with Ray Edwards, they got, you know, all the materials you've been supplying me with, and they're going to get this interview as well.
Yeah, and I'll put it out to mine as well, and I'm very flattered, but truthfully, I grow massively from celebrating and identifying and sort of liberating the brilliance that resides in somebody who has never really been provoked to express it in that way. So it's a privilege for me.
Thank you, Jack. It's, I'm a lucky guy to have a mentor like you. I really am.
Well, I think this turned out good.
Okay. Well, thanks. And
Brian, here's what I'll do. I think it really did turn out.